Welcome to Founders Focus, a podcast made for founders by founders. I'm Scott Case, CEO and co-founder of Upside, and I created Founders Focus to help share free resources and actionable advice. Together, we're building a community for business leaders, entrepreneurs, and founders to come together to tackle today's challenges. This podcast is powered by my awesome team at Upside. Please visit foundersfocus.com to join the live video sessions or to catch up on past topics. Today by, I think from Colorado, give me a little nod there. Yep, she's in Colorado, Dr. Paula Stone Williams. She's a national public speaker. She's most well known for her gender equity, LGBTQ inclusion and executive leadership. She's joined us today to talk a lot about her entrepreneurial journey, which is to say unusual would be an understatement, especially given all of her experiences throughout her life. So I'm very excited that she's going to be here today to talk about her journey from entrepreneurship to entrepreneurship, and I'll let her introduce herself, and then we'll get this party started. So Paula, welcome. Why don't you tell everybody a little about you?
Oh, it's so good to be with you. I am coming to you from Lyons, Colorado, which is close to Rocky Mountain National Park, and it's going to be 99 degrees today here, but I'm in a nice, comfortable house, so that's good and wonderful. I am, in fact, a co-pastor at Left Hand Church here in Longmont, Colorado. I'm also a pastoral counselor. I have a company, a C-Corp, RLT Pathways, that my former wife and I operate together. And that's the two major things that take up my time. I also speak all over the world on issues related to gender equity. I've done four TED Talks that have been pretty popular. My first one has already had over 3.6 million views. I've been very fortunate in that regard. I've spoken for a lot of corporations, Levi Strauss, the Bank of the West, Pinterest, Facebook, Goldman Sachs, and pretty much always in those situations talking about gender equity. It's been my real privilege to work with Upside, and I actually use them all the time as a positive example of a company trying to get it right when it comes to equity issues related to gender particularly, and also related to people of color. So that's pretty much my short version, and take it back to you, Scott.
Awesome, Paul. Yeah. We've had the privilege at Upside of having Paula speak to us a few times, and it's always extraordinary. So we're really fortunate to have her joining us today. So I want to start with a little bit of your sort of life journey, but in particular your professional life. You started and you were kind of an entrepreneur. You were in the process of starting, and I'll let you describe what kind of businesses you were starting and growing and nurturing, and came up with a formula. It was almost like a franchise model. And I got really, really good at it. And then your world changed in a meaningful way. And that created quite the disruption and opportunity that you've turned into being an entrepreneur. So just take 5, 6, 7 minutes to tell us a little bit about that sort of journey. And then we'll dive into some of the pieces of it.
Sure. So I went to seminary and found pretty quickly that it was not the kind of person who wanted to work within a local church as a pastor, that I was far too entrepreneurial in my particular approach to life. So instead, I became the CEO of a small organization on Long Island that started churches from scratch. So created these communities of faith from nothing. And initially, we would start churches that by year five would be averaging maybe 50 in attendance. They would top out at about 75. Now, these were Protestant churches, evangelical churches. And we were pretty comfortable with that because at that time in the United States, people who wanted to find a church and go to a church were just as happy with a church of 50 as they were with a church of 1,500. By 1990, however, we saw a major shift in the market in the United States where most people were preferring churches of 1,500 to 2,000. And so today, the most rapidly growing churches in the United States are churches that average over 2,000 in weekend attendance. There's 1,600 of them. There are actually more mega churches, they're called, in Nashville today than there were in the United States in the year 2000. 45 of 50 states have mega churches. If you happen to live in the northeastern United States, that's where the five states are that do not have them. The rest of the country, pretty much everybody knows what a mega church is. We have one in Boulder County that averages 25,000 in attendance. So we shifted the way we wanted to start churches. We looked at what is it that causes a church to grow rapidly, and we discovered it's pretty much the same thing that causes an organization to grow rapidly from scratch. It's hiring the right CEO and then funding the organization adequately. So my first and second master's degrees were in the area of industrial psychology, it was called then, corporate psychology, and we were looking for the kind of person who would be effective at starting something from scratch and seeing it grow rapidly. And we identified four different areas that were critical. Number one, vision, visionary. Martin Luther King Jr., I have a dream. Even George H.W. Bush in the 1988 presidential election, a long time ago, I can still remember his vision statements, 1,000 points of light, a kinder, gentler America, and unfortunately, no new taxes. But vision was the number one thing that we were looking for. Second thing we were looking for was intrinsic motivation, people who did not have to be awakened in the morning, but who could get by on 5 or 6 hours of sleep and who were willing to work hard all day, all the time, because that's what it takes to get something started from scratch. The third thing we were looking for was people who intuitively knew how to take risks and take them the kind of risks that were likely to pay off. Lots of people can take risks, but do they have the intuitive knowledge to know how to take risks that are likely to pay off? That's the third thing we looked for. And the fourth thing for us was the most important after vision itself. Did the person have a demonstrated ability to get people to buy into their vision? And the best indication of future behavior is past behavior. So we were looking to hire people who had a demonstrated ability to get people to buy into their vision. With those four things, intrinsic motivation, taking smart risks, vision, and the demonstrated ability to get people to buy into their vision, we started hiring lead pastors. And we also looked at why people came to a church and why they came back. They came because they heard about the church from someone who was a friend, generally coming because they wanted to hear the pastor and they thought the music was great. They came back because they liked what the pastor had to say and they loved the music. In other words, from an American consumer perspective, it was all about, if you will, the quality of the show. And so we knew that we needed to have great music, we needed to have great speakers, and within a short period of time, we had gone from starting new churches that were averaging 50 at 5 years of age to new churches that were averaging 500 at 5 years of age and averaging 2,000 at 10 years of age. We became one of the largest in the market. We went from Long Island to New York City, to New Jersey, to the Northeast, to the rest of the country, to Western Europe and Northern Asia, and became one of the top in the world at doing what we do, starting new churches from scratch. The second thing we knew that we needed was to fund them adequately. And so in our world, the version of VC was actually to go to already large churches and ask them for anywhere from $50,000 to $500,000 to help start a new church. So we funded these new churches with about, on average, $1.6 million. And we funded them with that because we hired the right kind of person who could get the job done. And in fact, it was like a franchise. We saw new churches in places which traditionally don't have churches that grow very effectively. My son actually still pastors one of those churches in Brooklyn, New York, a church that I swear half of Broadway goes to, which also is where their music is unbelievable in that church. Church of about 1,000 that's in downtown New York, Brooklyn, New York. So that was going wonderfully. I was their CEO for 25 years. I started when I was 12. We're going to go with that. So a quarter of a century, I was their CEO. And then I had known since I was 3 or 4 years of age that I was transgender. And 41% of those who are transgender eventually attempt suicide. My doctorate is in pastoral counseling. And I realized that people who deal with gender dysphoria, which is the technical name for being transgender, actually have a suicide rate 6 times higher than the next highest diagnosis. And I realized I wasn't really going to make it unless I transitioned. And so I transitioned, and within 7 days, lost every single one of my jobs. I'd been with that organization for 25 years, never had a bad review. I was gone within 7 days. I was also the editor at large of a national magazine, gone in 4 days there. No, actually, that one was also 7 days. I was on the preaching team of 2 megachurches, one in Philadelphia, one in Denver. I was gone from those 2 within a week. I lost my pension. I actually had about $500,000 of my own money on loan to the ministry that I worked with, and almost lost that, had to really fight to get that back. It's true that now, after the recent Supreme Court decision, you can't be fired for being transgender, but you still can be fired for being transgender if you work for a religious corporation, because in all 50 states, they are in fact immune from those laws. They are exempt from those laws. I like immune actually even better. So just like that, I had no work. That's the point at which my former wife and I, and we're still very close, started a C Corp, RLT Pathways, began working together as therapist counselors. That was pretty successful pretty fast. But in my heart, I like religious institutions. And the reason for that's kind of simple. That we as a species never did very well as a species until we moved from the level of blood kin to the level of the tribe. What was it that moved us from being a blood kin-based species where there wasn't much evolution to a tribal species where we made huge strides forward? And when we study that anthropologically, we realize that what brought people together was not the need for safety, as you might think. What brought people together as tribes was the need for meaning in life, to understand why we are here and for what purpose. And I found myself still drawn to do that, to create communities focused on determining meaning. What is it we're looking for in life? So I looked around at far more liberal churches and discovered that in the United States, virtually all of them are dying. All of the mainline Protestant churches at their current rates are going to be gone within 25 years. No entrepreneurs being hired there. Same thing's true in the Catholic Church in the United States. And so I looked around to see if we could find churches that were in fact focused on that great preaching, great music, and were in fact open to the LGBTQ population and far more theologically liberal. So also open to people from other backgrounds than Christian backgrounds. And I found a massive total of about 50 in the United States. So I pulled them together into a group. A bunch of us actually pulled them together into a group. And then we decided it was time to start a new church ourselves. And so instead of starting it with $1.6 million, we started it with 1/20th of that. We started it with $80,000, which meant that there were four of us who were co-pastors, one an acquisitions attorney from Boulder, one HR professional from Boulder County, one entrepreneur, and me. All of us making our living basically doing something else, all of us starting a church from scratch, no money. And so we switched to that entrepreneurial world and very quickly built up a group of about 100 people through word of mouth. Once you have about 100 people for a Sunday service, you've hit critical mass in the United States and you can start to advertise. We were just starting to advertise, had grown to about 125, and the pandemic hit. So that's the short, rapid story of my life.
That was amazing. We're going to come back to the pandemic hitting. So you know, a lot of entrepreneurs, particularly ones that are have either in your case built up a large organization, it's become the you know, in your case the CEO of a very large and successful institution, and you know, really for possibly some of the worst reasons, you got fired, and I had to figure out what to do from there. And so I'm curious about, you had to be going through a lot of emotions at that time about feelings of equity and the challenges that go along with that and all the changes of your own life. But I want to hone in on the, okay, now I got to make a living part of this. So what was the, just talk a little bit about what that was like in that moment where it's like, all right, and I got to go figure out my next thing here. And how did you make the choices that you made?
You know, I already had a small counseling practice. And one of the things I noticed is even though I had a fair number of conservative Christian people in that practice, I lost none of them when I transitioned. And so I realized pretty quickly that that in fact was a role I could continue to do and be able to make some money. My former wife had switched careers at that point, had become a therapist specializing in individuals who are adult survivors of sexual abuse. And so we formed a C Corp, and with my entrepreneurial skills, we became pretty successful pretty fast with that. And I still keep a small a practice, 4 or 5 people. I enjoy doing that work, but I'm wired to build something. I mean, that's just the person I am, the person I've always been. If you know your various psychological tests, I'm an ENTJ on the Myers-Briggs. I'm an ID combination, persuader pattern on the DISC. I'm an influencer, executor on the strengths finder. I want to create things from nothing. I'm a 3 on the Enneagram. And so I wanted to see if we could in fact go back to what I'd done before and start a new kind of religious community that in fact would be able to grow in that same way. And so fortunately for me, in the process of searching that out, I found one very liberal but progressive megachurch in Denver, Denver Community Church. They had me speak. NPR picked it up, from NPR picking it up. The TED folks found me and asked me if I would speak on discovering the differences between a very successful white American male and a transgender female. And I spoke about that. And that now has had over 3.6 million views. It ended up giving me a feature article, a 4,000 word feature article in the New York Times, being interviewed on Jada Pinkett Smith's Red Table Talk, a gig with TED itself, working as a TED ambassador, working for the TED Summit, and speaking all over the world on the issue of gender equity. Short answer there is that there's no way a well-educated white male can understand how much the culture is tilted in his favor. No way he can understand that, because it's all he's ever known and all he ever will know. And having lived both sides of that, I found myself pretty successfully talking about it, because there aren't many people who can talk from my perspective. And so figured out how to monetize that. And that then allowed me to take the time to start something else from scratch that I knew would not be financially lucrative ever, or even pay the bills for a long time, and starting a new church.
So it's fascinating to me, the journey, you know, that those kinds of disruptions and unexpected changes that a lot of entrepreneurs find themselves in and go off and either just get another job or spin something new up, as you did. I'm curious though, it was interesting when you talked about the 4 traits of what you were looking for, and presumably as you grow the church you're building now, you're looking for the same thing. At some point, somebody's gonna have to run the thing. So you talked about vision, you talked about the intrinsic motivation, people willing to take risks, and sort of the demonstrated ability to get others to buy in and carry them on. That's the description of every successful entrepreneur. And what's intriguing is we talked about it being, you know, the business is a religion. And not once did you mention faith in God or belief in scripture or the ability to like pull off a cool choir. It's like, yeah, great music, good storytelling, and bring it along. And so part of the story that I like about it is it applies, those traits apply to starting and creating almost anything from the ground up. And you've done that with Left Hand Church. And I just want to take on, you're probably looking for those traits and some of those points of view, but you also have an interesting tiger by the tail, because a lot of companies we talk about got, bam, all of a sudden their whole business models got disrupted and they couldn't figure it out. Then you had ones that became winning, and then you had ones that are still stuck trying to figure it out. You've had a very interesting experience over the last 4 months, going from an in-person, you know, faith-based community to something else. So tell us a little bit about that transition.
Well, one of the things that's true in this more conservative Christian world, which unfortunately is not an LGBTQ affirming world, the 100 largest churches in the United States are not LGBTQ affirming, not one single one of them. They won't tell you that, but that's the truth. These are all churches that average over 10, 15,000 in attendance. So while you have these mainline churches, and when I say mainline, I mean the Presbyterians, the Lutherans, the Methodists, all of these are declining denominations, in some measure, because they refuse to acknowledge that there are, in fact, a lot of positives to capitalism and a lot of positives to entrepreneurial ways of thinking. The more conservative churches have not had any difficulty grabbing onto that. And I think that's one of the reasons you see them growing. And of course, our desire is to create more liberal, more open, affirming kinds of faith-based organizations that will, in fact, grow rapidly, like any healthy organization is going to grow rapidly. So the ones that are making the fastest adaptation are, in fact, all those larger churches. The very first thing we did once it hit was to assess what our situation was, particularly look at finances. And because we were a new church and because we're smart, we had already moved 90% of our giving online. And so we saw that we did not lose but 5% of that giving. So we were still holding on to 95% of our giving. So financially, we knew we were initially going to be okay. We also knew pretty quickly that it was going to be at least October and quite possibly January before any of us were able to meet live again. And so we knew we had to adjust and adapt very quickly. We also knew it's not changed ever. What people are looking for in a religious experience generally is a great experience. And again, I won't even apologize for using the term. In a lot of ways, Americans' view of religion is transactional. They are looking for a great experience, for a great show, if you will. So right away, we saw we had an advantage, even as a small church, in going to video, that we had, in fact, two great speakers, and we had a great music program. We also had a good technical director. And so we made a shift very quickly to going online, and we now have been doing that for 22 straight weeks. We knew that our live audience would be like your live audience, not really all that huge. It could be anywhere from 40 to 80 people in any given week. But we thought maybe we'd be able to build our online audience. We particularly thought that might be true because I've heard from people on all seven continents about my TED Talks, including Antarctica. And so we began focusing in that area. And now just 4 months in, we actually have a larger online audience than almost any other church in the greater Denver region, including churches that are literally 25 to 50 times our size. Last weekend, we had people watching us, not just from Colorado, but from the Philippines, New Zealand, Australia, Brazil, Mexico, England, Ireland, Canada, and all across the United States. We took a look at that and realized we've got to monetize that pretty quickly. So how, in fact, can we do something about that? And so we look for opportunities that were national and international, where people could funnel funds to us in ways that would make up that 5% deficit that we had lost. And so Amazon Smile only gives you 0.5%, but the Kroger Corporation gives you a 5% return. So we started pointing our people in the direction of ways that they could give secondarily, where they weren't actually giving out of a regular giving pocket, since pretty much everybody I know has lost at least 20% of their income. In my case, I've lost all of my live speaking gigs, which is where the major part of my income comes from. So by making that shift, shifting over to the quality of presenting a very quality product for an hour each Saturday at 5, we also opted to go live at an unusual hour Saturday at 5 because we knew from our own research that Saturday at 5 is the least programmed hour, Saturday 4 to 6, the least programmed time in America. And so we knew that we had a better chance of a live audience if we focused on that particular time frame. We also then realized that we needed to be able to create Zoom opportunities. And so we created very significant offerings. So we have groups meeting every single week that are anti-racist, anti-ableist groups, groups focused on gender equity, groups focused just on talking about how to get through the pandemic, on how to find employment opportunities. All of that are areas that we've been focusing on. And we also have what we call a virtual branch so that people from all over the world can join together and just talk about their experience, since this is a worldwide experience. For us, we also realized then that this is going to go with us into the future because our live venue has not been the best venue video-wise. And we recognize going forward, we're actually going to have a larger video audience, a larger online audience than we have live. And so we're now looking at a potentially new space that we can make look like a really cool background that also will work, that will work well live, but also will work well for video. We've been functioning through Facebook on that because it allows the live comments, which is an important part of keeping all of that alive. We do all of our other stuff on Zoom. And so for us, it's really, you know, you do what you need to do if you're thinking entrepreneurially. We've figured out how to make this work, and we're thinking now about what are we going to do once we meet again. We do meet live now outside, and we have people who are able to sign up. We only have about 20 that we're allowing to come, and we're doing social distancing. Everybody has to wear a mask, but that is getting us a little bit more energy to our services.
That's really cool. You brought up something that's really important, which is basically figuring out what are the elements that you're doing, that you were doing pre-pandemic, so having a live congregation, and then recognizing that, wow, we've learned something in the pandemic time that we want to actually carry forward regardless, right? Your point about choosing a new venue. And I think for a lot of entrepreneurs, starting to think about, okay, what are the elements that we're experiencing in our businesses now that we should take forward post-pandemic, kind of regardless of what happens with the coronavirus and the pandemic itself. And it's running those experiments and starting to think that stuff through is really, really important. I want to turn to a couple of questions that we've got from the folks that are here. One is, The methodology you used for 25 years in building and growing these mega churches, is there anything different because you're promoting or engaging, looking for a more liberal and inclusive churches, or is it the same process? It's just that there hasn't been an investment made yet to create the next wave of 1,600 mega churches that are more inclusive?
There are three massive shifts taking place in Christianity today. But when you take a look at any religion, it has about a 500-year span before it makes a major shift. And we're seeing a major shift in the broad Christian world. This is worldwide. We're seeing a shift from orthodoxy to orthopraxy. So a shift from right belief, believing a particular number of things, to how well you love one another. And so that for us became a major focus. We talk about loving God well, and we define God, I define God in this way every single time. The God who burst on the scene 14 billion years ago, and all of God's complexity, mystery, expansiveness, which basically is the Big Bang, describing it that way. So loving God, loving the universe, loving the planet, loving neighbor, and loving self. So that's the shift from orthodoxy to orthopraxy. That's already taking place. There's a shift from God as eternal threatener to God as ultimate suffering participant. For the last 500 years, Christianity and a lot of the desert religions, all the desert religions, Christianity, Islam, Buddhism, are religions of scarcity. Islam. Christianity, Judaism, Islam, the Abrahamic religions are religions of scarcity. And in their fundamentalist forms, they remain religions of scarcity. There's those who are in, there are those who are out. And so there's a lot of focus on heaven and hell. We're seeing a shift away from that focus, from God as the one who's going to send you to hell, to God as the one who is working with us in our own suffering. That's why you see even a lot of evangelical churches making this shift to focusing on Black Lives Matter, something you would not have seen 10 years ago. The third shift is churches used to take the perspective, we want to be the best church in town. No longer. We now take the perspective, we want to be the best church for the town. What are the needs of this city that aren't being met by existing social service agencies, and what can we do to meet those needs? And so, for instance, one of the mega churches I used to work with here in Boulder County, I became the number one provider of foster care in the county, the number one provider of tutoring into school systems in the town. When we had a huge flood, it became the major social service agency to take care of the needs of that flood. So those are the three shifts we're seeing, and America is already there. You take the LGBTQ issue, for instance, 83% of non-religious Americans are supportive of marriage equality. 71% of Catholics are supportive of marriage equality. 51% of millennial evangelicals are even supportive of marriage equality. It's the leadership and the older money that has not shifted yet. So the market is pretty much the same. What we see is an emerging market, and that's why I know that we're going to see the kinds of churches we're starting now grow very, very rapidly. We just don't have the kind of money that we had before.
Awesome. All right, I'm going to turn to a couple of other things. I want to pile on to one thing that you said that's really powerful, and I think it's a way for any entrepreneur to think about their own businesses. Being the biggest or the best in the market is very different than being the best for the market. In your case, it was for a community, but what are you doing to be of service to all your stakeholders, et cetera, and you'll be able to build a much bigger and more successful company with that mindset. I've got two challenging questions for you that I'm sure you're gonna knock out of the park. I'll give you the easier of the two. As an individual founder, like a solopreneur, if you will, what advice do you have to kind of elevate those four dimensions for yourself? The combination of, you know, where do you start, for example? So looking at the traits of vision, a lot of entrepreneurs have those pieces, but when you look at the intrinsic motivation that people have, figuring out how to bring others along, what do you think the most important thing is for somebody to make sure they've kind of leveled up in?
You know, I think when it comes to intrinsic motivation, the most important thing is to believe in your product. And so for me, I had a hard time remaining in evangelicalism when I was no longer an evangelical theologically. But to bring people together, to try to understand the basic meaning of life and to try to help love one another well, I believe in that. And so for me, that's the huge part of intrinsic motivation. But when I look at the things I've learned since transitioning particularly, I'm a far better leader now than I was before. And if you take a look at what's happened post-pandemic at the various nations, there are three nations that kind of stick out as not having handled this all that well. Great Britain, the United States, and Brazil. All three strong male leaders with great ego need and little ego strength. On the other hand, take a look at Finland, Norway, Iceland, New Zealand, Taiwan. All of these female heads of state nations are doing extremely well. I think it's because they have identified some of the key elements that are necessary in the time of a pandemic if you're going to grow in the area of being a visionary leader and getting people to buy into your vision. Katerina Georgieva, who's head of the IMF, spoke at the most recent TED, and I was serving as a speaker's ambassador for that, which meant that I get to be involved in all of those. And she was talking about why these nations have done better in the pandemic. And I think she's on to something. She says female leaders tend to be more inclusive than male leaders. They tend to be able to bring everyone in better as opposed to separating them out. And I think that's something I have learned to do post-transition. A second, I have a far greater willingness to be corrected now than I did when I was a male. When I was a male, I tended to want to push through my agenda. And now I see much more quickly if something isn't working, well, let's not go that direction. Let's back up and go in a different direction. That's what I mean by greater ego strength and less ego need. We see that these female people, heads of state, have a greater ego strength than need. They're willing to be corrected, to recognize very quickly that they're going down the wrong direction. New Zealand just went into a hard lockdown again. I mean, she knows what she's doing down there. Of very quickly making those adjustments. Women tend to be more collaborative in their leadership. I think that's one of the things I see now working in a church. I'm far more collaborative than I was before. I was pretty collaborative as a guy, but way more as a female. I'm also more willing to compromise. And that's an art that, Tip O'Neill and Ronald Reagan were pretty good at it. We've lost much ability to do that in our current times. I also see with these female leaders, I think, a real key to leading in difficult times. They all have two factors of character. They have great confidence coupled with great humility. And you think about the great leaders always are people of great confidence coupled with great humility. Now, I don't know what your historical perspective is on Hamilton or on George Washington, but if you take a look at how George Washington is presented in the book and also in the musical, you see that he, in fact, would have been someone who had both great confidence and great humility. Quite clearly, Abraham Lincoln was someone of great confidence and great humility. And you see that in every one of these female heads of state. You see this great confidence coupled with great humility. And frankly, you see that more often in female CEOs than you do in male CEOs. I spoke to about 150 female founder CEOs at Forbes magazine back about 12 months ago, actually. And the one thing that I noticed there was exactly that. There was in these people great confidence, but there weren't very many of them that were, you know, the Devil Wears Prada. The vast majority of them also had that humility, willing to work collaboratively, willing to be corrected, willing to compromise, resilient. And I think that is what's necessary in leadership in these times.
Absolutely. So I've got one, I'm going to land on one last question for you that is almost impossible to answer in the 2 minutes we have left. So I'm going to give you all 3 minutes. That's 50% more. Okay. But if you had one piece of advice for someone to discover the meaning in their life, it was a softball question for you. So if you had one thing to do that says to someone, hey, if you're looking to find, you know, discover the meaning in your life, what's the thing that they could do?
I'm a person-centered therapist, which means that I recognize that the answer is always within my client. It's not mine. And I think we have to learn to look within. I think that probably one of the best leaders for that right now in these times is the Jungian analyst James Hollis. And I think one of the most, one of the strongest things I could recommend is take, during the pandemic, his little book, Living an Examined Life, Wisdom for the Second Half of the Journey. It's 21 short chapters, and it is inviting you to move from success to significance. You know, when we move into the second half of life, we're no longer building resume virtues. We're now building eulogy virtues. We have fewer friends, but deeper friendships. We look less outside of ourselves for our sense of strength, more deep within our own soul. But we also are more prone to see the risks that we must take going forward, that it is still a time that we are needing to be risk takers. And I love his book, Living an Examined Life, because basically he says, you've known since you were a little tiny thing, it wasn't the big people who were going to tell you who you were. It's you who are going to tell you who you are. Even after Odysseus gets back home, what happens to him? Late in life, he's given one last call. He's told to take an oar to go inland until he finds a place where nobody knows what an oar is, and he's to plant it there as an offering to the god Poseidon. Only then can he return home to live into sleek old age. I think that would be my advice to people seeking meaning at this point. You're entrepreneurs. What are you being called to now? What's the oar you've got to take inland and plant where people don't even know what an oar is? And I think Hollis's book is a great place to do that. I'm on my second time through right now, Living an Examined Life. I just read one chapter a day and spend some time thinking about it. I think I took longer than 3 minutes.
Nah, you did a fantastic job. You're a total, absolute rock star. So thank you for being here today. Really appreciate it. Lots of unbelievable pearls of wisdom, and really appreciate your generosity in sharing the roller coaster ride that you've been on for a long time. It's awesome to hear. Thanks for tuning in to this episode of Founders Focus. What did you think? You got any feedback for us? Got a topic that you'd like us to discuss? Or maybe a future co-host? We'd love to hear from you. Just hit me up on LinkedIn at tscottcase and join us at foundersfocus.com to stay up to date with the latest episodes, and join us live every week at our Founders Focus sessions. Hope to see you there.